Thank you.
Very good.
Maybe we could start out with your background. You're from Greece, and you came over to attend Brown University. Can you tell me a little bit about your family and your background growing up in Greece?
Yes, I'll be happy to. I was born in Turkey in 1922, in that 3 months from parents that were of Greek descent in Turkey. There were about a million of us. And I had to leave there when I was 3 months old because, as you probably know, Turkey decided to expel all Christians. And 1 million Greeks had to leave Turkey and go to Greek mainland.
Mm-hmm.
My father was in the diplomatic service, Greek diplomatic service. He was governor of North Africa, of northern Greece. And then at about the age of, by the way, the Greek king and the queen were my godparents. And then when I was 7 years old, we moved to British East Africa because father was, at the request of the British government, co-governor of British East Africa. It's a long story. I don't need to go into it, but I was in what is now Tanzania, in Dar es Salaam, where the head of the British territories, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanganyika then. I was there until the age of 14, 7 years. Then I went back to Greece. I entered the what's called Athens College, which is the Greek American high school and prep school. And I was in my senior year there when the war was declared. I volunteered, as all my classmates did, in the Greek army. The British had come over, so we, with English language capabilities, were attached to the British. To make a long story short, I fought against the Italians who attacked us, and then as a second lieutenant, and then I fought with the Germans. And the last minute, when we were ready to evacuate to North Africa, I was asked if I can stay and become, go in the underground. And I, long story short, I was a member of MI6, British intelligence. I was taken by submarine to North Africa. From occupied Greece, I fought at El Alamein. Then I was parachuted back to Greece, and I was there until its liberation. I published last 6 months ago a book, a personal novel, a biographical novel of my days in the German Messerschmitt factory in Greece, and as a spy. And the last minute, I was about to go back to Africa when I got a scholarship for Brown University. Mm-hmm. I came to Brown University. They gave me credit for the freshman year. 3 years later, I went to Harvard and get my doctorate degree in organic chemistry. And then I joined Monsanto.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions here. At the time, well, first of all, the memoir that you wrote, what's the title of that? Is it available for us to...
Yes, it is. You can get it at Amazon. If you type in Anagnostopoulos, Athens, Black. It's, the title of the book is Athens in Black.
Athens in Black, okay.
Yeah, and because that's the expression of Greek when you're in mourning.
Mm. I see.
Mm-hmm. And it's a hard-covered book, And the leaf outside the leaflet has my painting. I'm a painter as well. Has my painting of the Acropolis with the swastika.
You came from a prominent family, so you had opportunities, the best educational opportunities. I guess your life was disrupted. Everybody in Greece at that time, life was disrupted by the war. But had it been expected, perhaps, that you would go to the United States? Was there a sense that the United States had the best universities and you would end up here?
No. I was planning to go to Witwatersrand University in Johannesburg for my undergraduate, and then go to Oxford for my graduate work.
I see.
There were the original plans. Obviously, I had a British citizenship as well as a Greek citizenship, so it was obvious that I was looking to Britain for my education. And then all of a sudden I was called to the American Embassy and told that I had a full scholarship, plus $100 a month, to come to Brown University. It was because many American colleges at that time wanted foreign students from allied nations. And that was the reason I got it. So as soon as the American Embassy called me and told me that, it was obviously no... There was no question in my mind. By that time, of course, don't forget that before the war, America wasn't the prominent country. The British Empire was.
Right.
But during the war, obviously, America became, and it was obvious, probably if I had gone to Johannesburg for my undergraduate, I would have gone to America for my graduate work. Because by that time, America became the prominent country in the world. So that's the situation.
Right. You, as an undergraduate, you majored in chemistry. When did you first become interested in science?
Originally, I was intended to be an engineer for some reason or another, but at Athens College, which is the name, was still the prominent high school in Greece, and I had a chemistry professor that just totally changed my mind. So from my almost from my sophomore high school years, I was dedicated to chemistry. So I learned everything I can during chemistry. During the war, I carried two chemistry books with me. And that is the reason why, in part of my education and part of my studying from those books, organic chemistry primarily, why I was chosen. By the way, I registered at the university, as we do in Greece, before, and took the exams before you graduate from high school. And I came first in the class. So when Brown University wanted a chemistry major from Greece, he went to the university and to Athens College, of course, but went to the university and asked who is top of the class to be admitted and who knows good English. And obviously my name popped up, and that's how I got the scholarship at Brown. At Brown University, I got the chemistry prize, highest honors in chemistry, graduated magna cum laude, and it was a cinch to go to Harvard.
And at that time, Harvard, did it have a reputation as the best or one of the best chemistry departments?
In organic chemistry, Professor Woodward and Professor Caesar were the top chemistry professors at Brown, and world known. I worked for Fieser, Professor Fieser, who was the top steroid chemist. And then he and Woodward decided to develop the total synthesis of cortisone. Verizon was something new then. It was obtained from plants in Mexico. But we wanted to elucidate its total structure, and I contributed to that. And then Professor Woodward got the Nobel Prize for it.
Yeah, did you work with anybody at Syntex at that time?
At Syntex, no. Although I was familiar with Syntex, because we other professors, other graduate students worked for, did some work for Syntex, which was, of course, the steroid top person at that time.
Right.
Yeah.
You went through graduate school pretty quickly. You graduated from Brown in 1949. You have a master's the next year, and two years later, you're awarded a PhD. That's pretty rapid.
Yes, it is. For a number of reasons. One is a funny one, but the one is obviously that my nitration of alcohols, which were important for the 11 oxygen of steroids, which is a difficult and blocked position. So I did have luck in doing my project within about a year and a half, actually. The other thing was that Professor Fieser was, as his books always indicate, a lover of cats. And my wife was also a lover of cats, so there was that relationship as well, so he might have favored me. But, yes, and one summer I worked briefly for Monsanto that had laboratories in Everett, Massachusetts. And they were impressed with me, and I was impressed with them, and they said to me, as soon as you graduate from Harvard, you are welcome to come to Monsanto. So I really didn't interview. I went directly to Monsanto.
Did you ever consider an academic career?
Yes, I did. And my professor, Woodward, had nothing to do, I mean, although he worked with pharmaceutical companies, he and Professor Fieser told me that I would be best if I go to academia for my talents, etc. So I interviewed in, I had interviews in a couple of universities. One was Columbia, the other one was Wayne University here in Detroit, and I was accepted by both, but I had done some work at Monsanto in a product that eventually became a $200 million product, and I was intrigued with it, so I went to Monsanto.
What was that project and product?
That product, believe it or not, is do you have any chemistry background?
No, I'm my background is in biology.
Oh, okay. And, not dissimilar, but in chicken feed, the limiting amino acid is methionine. And DuPont made some methionine and added to chicken feed. But most of the methionine came from a byproduct fish of the fishing industry. And it caused some problems with the taste of chicken. So I looked at the amino acid, and I was wondering whether we can make it in a cheaper way. I was a summer student. Summer student there. And I thought that perhaps transamination might be possible. Actually, I and another fellow, so I didn't get the credit of only me. So we made the hydroxy analog instead of the amino acid analog, and lo and behold, the body converted it into the D amino acid which was the active, dimethionine, which was active. And still that product is used in all chicken feeds today. It's about 300 million.
Yeah. Did you have to do a taste test to confirm the results?
Yeah, we had chicken by the hundred. The controls, we always had controls, obviously. The controls were taken by us, and our freezer was full of chicken.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you had a positive experience then working for Monsanto, and you didn't think twice about taking a position as a PhD chemist. You were assured that you would be doing work that was exciting and innovative?
Yes, of course. And after about 3 years, 4 years with them, I forget now the exact amount, I was made a scientist. Mm-hmm. Being a scientist, which was a high level of independent research. Mm-hmm. But then one day, the head of the research department came to me and said, would you like to try administrating research a bit? And I said, yes, I would try that. I would love to try that. So they sent me to Charleston, West Virginia, where there were the rubber chemical laboratories of Monsanto. Mm-hmm. And I was head of those labs. I enjoyed managing research. I was there only 4 months. I did so well, Monsanto called me back and gave me the job of my boss, which was the head of the research department. And so I was that for a while. Mm-hmm. Well, not for a while, but quite a few years.
So director of R&D, organic chemicals?
Director of R&D, the organic chemical division, mm-hmm. of Monsanto. Monsanto had three divisions. Yeah. And I enjoyed that very much. And then they said, well, can you now manage some companies, some divisions? Mm-hmm. I said, fine. I started with the functional fluids. I went to textiles. I went to rubber chemicals, and so it was obvious that they were training me for better jobs, so I became vice president of the rubber chemicals division when the division separated as independent.
Right, and that's 1975, I believe, but this is after... you went into that position after the new enterprise, after doing the venture.
Correct. Yeah. Yes, the new enterprise division, let me look at my experience. Mm-hmm. The new enterprise division, was from 71 to 75.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then the rubber chemicals division was until 80. Mm-hmm. And 80, then 80 was the year that we decided to restructure Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
Well, probably, did you read my write-up on managing change?
I haven't looked at that yet, no.
Okay, that describes a lot about me. Mm-hmm. There as well, but when we decided to change Monsanto, now Monsanto had a very interesting objective, that at the end of every decade, the profits, the bottom line, 50% or more of the bottom line must be in products and businesses we were not in 10 years ago.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. So every decade we changed, and successfully we did that. We were first in chemicals after the war, then we went into plastics, Then we went into textiles.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went into agricultural chemicals. And then we ventured into pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1980, after we... Let me go back for a minute.
Sure.
Our venture capital group, which I started in the New Enterprise Division.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me how that came about?
Yes, I'll be happy to.
Mm-hmm.
When I took over the New Enterprise Division, which was by that time about 1 year old, but it was the first year was just on a test to see whether it is worth having a separate division that creates the next business for the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I took over the New Enterprise Division, and I soon realized that while there were enough ideas within Monsanto to start new businesses, and we always wanted to start new businesses that had some acquaintance or some umbilical cord to our present businesses.
Mm-hmm.
We did not want to go into business we knew nothing about.
Right.
So afterward, I took the New Enterprise and looked around. I found some ideas, but I said they're not enough for us for the New Enterprise to become a important, viable enterprise for Monsanto. So I said, I need a set of eyes and ears into the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, the large companies like DuPont and General Electric and the Monsanto were kind of isolated islands. They were so self-sufficient that they did not look to the outside for much.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I need to look to the outside. So I said I have to set some eyes and ears into the outside world. And I went about doing that in two major ways. First, I started the first corporate venture capital group,
mm-hmm.
Innoven.
Right.
And I started that in 1971 or 2, I don't remember exactly now.
Mm-hmm.
I think 72.
Okay.
I brought in a venture capital, a guy with some experience in venture capital, because in 1972, although venture capital was in existence, it wasn't very, very broadly recognized.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's certainly not a venture capital group that that was funded solely by one corporation and asked to look around for opportunities that might be pertinent to the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
So the charter I gave to Innoven was look in the outside, see whether there are any companies that can be pertinent to Monsanto's existing businesses, but also look at technologies that might be emerging that will be pertinent to Monsanto, that they have an umbilical cord to Monsanto's technical capabilities, market existence, etc.
Right.
Market service, etc.
I have two questions. One is the idea of looking to the outside. Were you aware, were you looking at any corporate models of others who were other large corporations who were doing the same thing, or did this come about as a recognition internally by you of the need to do this?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
when I decided to establish an Innovim, I wanted to go around, I went around to see if there are other companies that are looking on the outside. Mm-hmm. And there were none in the very beginning when the idea came to me first. But I soon realized, and because I went to MIT, and I wanted MIT to tell me what, as you probably know, MIT was closer to industry than Harvard ever was.
Right.
And so I went to MIT and I was asking if they knew anybody else that was doing what I was doing. And they said, yeah, I think GE and Exxon are trying to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I contacted them.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, there was Exxon Enterprise and Chevenco, mm-hmm. the two companies that were trying to do similar things, but they were only looking at companies that they could acquire.
I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was in essence a venture capital group, but it was directed not to new and different business for GE and Exxon, but related to their present business for expansion purposes.
Mm-hmm.
When we got together, by the way, we had a major argument. I always believe that venture capital cannot be run by a corporation.
Mm-hmm.
It requires quick actions, it requires actions with minimum knowledge, and it can't. Javenko and GE Enterprise said, of course we can run the business
mm-hmm.
ourselves. Well, the result was that in 10 years they were gone.
Yes.
And Monsanto today has two venture capital groups.
Mm-hmm.
So venture capital became a permanent fixture with Monsanto. Anyway, so that was the first thing. I said, look outside and see what there is, primarily for us to start the business of the next decade.
Yeah, and the idea of venture investing, were you aware, you went to MIT, and you know this is at a time when venture capital is getting going around Boston, Route 128, and I guess at the same time getting going also on the West Coast in Silicon Valley. How aware of those developments were you at the time?
I was quite aware of those developments, mostly in the East Coast, the Route 128.
Mm-hmm.
But many of them were not relevant to Monsanto.
Right.
Although, because of them, we started a number of things in Monsanto and New Enterprise. We started things that were still had some relationship, but weren't, the umbilical cord wasn't, you know, big enough or short enough, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our venture into silicon wafers, where we became the first producer of silicon wafers in the United States. We made the first, we were contributory to the first light-emitting diodes. We worked with General Electric to make CD, to record things on a plate instead of a tape, mm-hmm. etc. And we tried that, and we thought that would be our next major thrust.
Mm-hmm.
Because after all, there was chemistry involved. It might have been inorganic chemistry, but was chemistry involved.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we started doing non-woven textiles and things like that, all testing the opportunities for our next decade. Mm-hmm. And this went on until 1975. When Innovim came to me, I remember the breakfast we had with the head of Innovim, he came to me and he said, there is a new term out there, and there is a new conference to be held, and the term is biotechnology, and the meeting is it's Salomer, hold on a minute, I forget the name of it. There's a conference in 1975, mm-hmm. Which we attended. I forget the name now. Mm-hmm. It's Salomer. Hold on, I have it here.
Okay.
I'll look at it in a minute. Sure. But anyway, he said, there's this conference going on where a biotechnology is going to be discussed. So I immediately sent to that conference the closest I had to people with knowledge pertinent to that technology. And they came back and they said to me, there is a genetic-related activity going on, and I think we better pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm. These are people within the company that you went to, within Monsanto?
Mostly the people that came from our agricultural division.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Because at that time we did not have, with the exception of we were the largest producer of aspirin in the United States, and we had we made the L-DOPA intermediate, etc. So we were involved to some degree in intermediate, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
not very sophisticated pharmaceuticals. So the closest to we felt that would be the agricultural division, who at that time was trying to find ways to quickly evolve our pharmaceutical, our agricultural products that we're working in,
mm-hmm.
like soybean and other products.
Right.
So they went to the conference, and they came back and said, that seems to be a totally new technology that is going to revolutionize certainly medicines. It's going to probably revolutionize agricultural plants and products. And we had some nutritional capabilities by then. We had some products that went into like baking soda and something like that we were making.
Mm-hmm.
So they told me that they thought they were going to revolutionize these three products. So our decision immediately was to start looking into the biotechnology. And we said, well, how are we going to do that? So let me go back, however.
Okay.
When I said that in 1972 I started the venture capital group, I also did another thing. I went to three major universities, and I decided to give each of I, the board, decided that my recommendation, to give each of these three universities about $15 million each, and do the following. Let the professors in those universities bid for these funds. Mm-hmm. The three universities were Oxford, Harvard, and Washington University in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
Of the people that bid for those millions, in Oxford were Professor Dweck, who became prominent into the sugars that surround all proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And at Harvard was Judah Faulkman, who was the pioneer of angiogenesis.
Mm-hmm.
And at Harvard was Dr. Schneiderman. At Washington University was Dr. Schneiderman, mm-hmm. who developed Celebrex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, with that background of those universities, we decided to go to each of these universities and direct the taking of the part of the $15 million in areas that were biotechnology related. That's why Dweck became a major taker of those millions, Faulkman and Schneiderman, all of them biotechnology related projects.
Mm-hmm.
We did something else when we realized that biotechnology was becoming a prominent, the biotechnology revolution was real. We decided to invest in every major biotechnology company. And we invested in Genentech. Mm-hmm. We invested in Genex. We invested in Biogen. Actually, GeneX, we started it. We helped start it in our venture capital group.
Mm-hmm.
Helped started it. In Biogen, we had our vice chairman sit on the board of it. We also did another thing. We went and got Schneiderman from the University of California at Irvine, and we made him head of our central research.
Mm-hmm.
Which then the central research directed all its efforts to biotechnology-related products, to the tune that by 1980, 5 years after the conference, we were spending about $120 million in biotechnology.
Mm-hmm.
We soon realized that if biotechnology will impact two industries in which we liked to be in, one of which we were in, and that was agriculture, and the other one was pharmaceuticals. Monsanto always wanted to be in the pharmaceutical industry, and that was then, soon after that, actually quite a few years after that, we acquired Cyril to become the center of our pharmaceutical. But let me go back for a minute, back into 1980.
Yes.
After we made the decision that biotechnology-related or impacted products in agriculture and pharmaceuticals are going to be our major next thrust, we decided to split the company, because until then all of Monsanto's products were based on petrochemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation in petrochemicals of 1972, when the new enterprise division was created, told us that perhaps at one point in time in our history we should divert from products that are based on petrochemicals. So biotechnology-based products for our future were advantageous, or met that decision to veer away from petrochemical-based products. So in 1980, we decided that we had to make a decision, or the board had to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And that decision was whether we enter biotechnology as we had as we began to do very intensively, in parallel to everything else we were doing, and wait until our biotechnology created enough business and profits, then we can get out of some of the products that were based on petrochemicals, and we were not number one or two in it.
Mm-hmm.
Or the alternative was to dispose of those products and get into biotechnology in parallel with whatever we retained.
Mm-hmm.
We decided to do that.
Hmm.
So I was asked to pioneer that corporate movement.
Yeah.
So I went to Europe. When I went, I was asked to go to Europe and become the chairman, CEO, and managing director of Monsanto Europe, mm-hmm. Africa, Middle East,
mm-hmm.
India. It was about almost half of Monsanto's business. It was about $3.5 billion. And I went there and I stayed there for 2 years. And when I left, the businesses in this area of the world was less than $1 billion. We disposed of almost all our petrochemical operations.
Mm-hmm.
Some went to Bayer and some went to ICI. And so then I came back and I was put in charge of the restructuring of Monsanto.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. During this period, this seems like, and maybe it felt this way, I don't know, it seems like a risky strategy to get out of established business into this new technology, which at this time really hadn't been entirely proven, correct?
That is correct. And that's why I told you it was a major decision,
mm-hmm.
that we had to make. But we did make it for a number of reasons. Let me go back to 1971.
Okay.
And all this is summarized in the document I've sent Cassandra.
Okay.
So you can refresh your memory reading that.
Right.
In 1971, we brought in, for the first time ever, a CEO from the outside world.
Hmm.
I was actually on the committee that were trying to find one from the outside. The reason for that was this. All Monsanto's previous CEOs were not necessarily members of the founder's family, but they came from inside the company.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, to a large degree, entrepreneurs on their own right.
Mm-hmm.
So Monsanto was managed in a more personal, entrepreneuring way.
Mm-hmm.
It was not managed in a professional way, in the sense of by an experienced individual who at that time who would be more of a classical CEO than an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided, once we decided to bring in a professional CEO, we looked around, and obviously Procter & Gamble was the example that we wanted to copy, and so we went and we got the number two man from Procter & Gamble.
Mm.
And so we brought him in. He came in, and it was about the time that we were considering changing, considering bringing the next decade in. So he came in, and he looked at the company and he said it spoke primarily to the new enterprise division who was looking for the next decade, etc. It was about the time of the oil embargo situation we had. And so he made his mind up that he will try to get into a business that is less, that is, has a lower dependence on petrochemicals.
Mm-hmm.
So he was prepared for the advent of biochemistry,
mm-hmm.
which is an important consideration any time the company wants to move into a new field that, you know, the top CEO is totally committed to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's vital for that change to happen.
Right.
And so, yes, in 1980, 10 years later, when we decided to go with the approach of divesting the petrochemical-based products that we were not number one or two, that our top CEO was committed to doing that, and so we proceeded in spite of the fact that they were, that there was a greater risk of failure than otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
We are now in the process of splitting up the company.
And this is, I'm sorry, this is after 1980 when the split occurs, yeah?
That's correct.
Can I ask a few questions about prior to 1980?
Oh, please do.
When you're making investments in, you mentioned the companies, Biogen, Genentech, Collagen, Genex. I would like to hear how you evaluated these technologies and these particular companies, and one company that's missing from the list is Cetus. Was Cetus on your radar at all at that time?
No, it was not.
Mm-hmm.
Cetus later, we became, as I will mention later, we came to know Cetus a bit, but no, Cetus was not in that area.
Mm-hmm.
We were primarily involved, although invested in Genentech. I'm trying to get here, just one second. Oh, the conference in 1975 I was mentioning was the Alisoma.
Oh, right, this is what the question about the recombinant DNA. And yes.
Alisoma conference.
Right, yes.
Mm-hmm. That was what triggered. That was what triggered us.
I see.
Yeah, and so in Biogen was the closest we were with.
Uh-huh.
As I said, Schneiderman, who was then head of our central research, was in their planning or execution committee. Our vice chairman Fernandez. Lou Fernandez was on the board,
mm-hmm.
and Genex was a company that our venture capital group established, funded rather,
mm-hmm.
became the major funded in it,
mm-hmm.
and also, of course, Genentech. I recall the heads of this, Boyer and Swanson.
Right.
From Genentech,
mm-hmm.
He was invited many times to talk to our board.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very nice, all of them, in terms of interacting with our top management,
mm-hmm.
and kind of give them some confidence that this new technology is... will have a major impact in, I remember talking to them and while they said, obviously it's going to have an impact on your pharmaceutical venture, I don't know about agriculture, but we looked into it, and our agricultural group looked into it in great depth, and they said, yes, bioengineered products will undoubtedly dominate the world in a couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be deeply into it. I can talk about that in some detail at any time you wish.
Yes, please. I would like to hear more about that, especially considering that Monsanto is the first to recognize that, and in agriculture, at least this is my perception, I could be wrong, but Monsanto was way ahead of everybody else in the field in terms of getting into recombinant DNA.
It sure is today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, the way it came about, we were hoping that agriculture would be one of our major products in one of the decades. And in the beginning, we started with making some weed killers, etc. We became quite prominent.
Mm-hmm.
Then one day, in my organic research lab, when I was in charge of organic research from 72 to 76, one of our research chemists came in and said to me, I have developed a product that will kill anything that has leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, that would be important. It will kill all weeds, etc., etc. And I went to the marketing department of the organic chemical division, and I told them about this product.
Mm-hmm.
And their answer was, "What we need a product that kills every plant. Why don't you give us more selective products?"
Uh-huh.
Which we had some, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I still thought that would be a major, major product. So, but I didn't know how to go about it, since our marketing department and our management didn't consider it as a major development.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I was in the Far East that I was asked to go to one of the rubber chemical plantations.
Mm-hmm.
Because organic division was deeply in rubber chemicals.
Right.
And we were the prominent, we had about 80% of the market.
Hmm.
I went to the plantation and I noticed that they had about 12 individuals cutting the grass around the plantation, the rubber trees.
Mm-hmm.
Then I said to them, what if I give you a product that will kill everything that's on the ground? Obviously not the rubber trees, because their leaves are way up high and they won't be affected. They said they'd love that, and that's how Roundup was created.
Uh-huh.
And from there on, it was easy to go. And the next was Missouri's Highway Department, who used it to kill weeds by the road.
Mm-hmm.
So Roundup was created.
Right. What was the duration between the time that the chemist first came to you and said, I have this compound, and and you said there was a problem getting it adopted, and this is after 1980 when you're in the Far East. How long did it take before there was action on Roundup?
Well, the chemist came to me, I think it was in 1960. I was research director 62 to 68.
Hmm.
It came in 1965.
Ah.
and the product was not ongoing until about 9 years later.
I see.
As a major product, and of course it became a billion-dollar product.
Right.
So the agricultural division all of a sudden had money coming out of their ears. Using some of that for the next opportunity in biotechnology was not something that they had to beg for money, and they could go about it. We decided how to go about it. We recognized early on that there would be a tremendous resistance to having bioengineered products.
Did you have this idea from Asilomar? Is that the fact that there was controversy about it?
No, we thought that people who sit at the table and have bread placed before them, if you told them that the wheat that was in that bread was genetically engineered, they will revolt. So what we decided to do was attack products that are not recognized by people as coming from bioengineered products. And those were, we say, definitely not wheat. We started with cotton.
Right.
To make cotton resistant to cotton weaver. And we said nobody will ever ask whether cotton was made from bioengineered plants or not. Then we decided to go to soy, because not too many people associate soy with the table.
In the U.S., at least.
U.S., anyway. And then we said, okay, we will also go to some of the other products at that time. Haynes came to us at that time and said, could you genetically engineer tomatoes so they won't have that much water, which we have to kind of, you know, pay for when we move tomatoes around. We said, no, we won't do that, because tomato is something that is on the dining table, and we're not going to do that. So we started with soy, and then we went to corn, and we went to corn that it was for animal feeding.
Right.
Because that way also will not be recognized at the table. That is the reason for that. The reason for us staying away from wheat and staying away from products, vegetables, etc. And we did then progress quite rapidly. And we now, of course, are the prominent, they have about 60% of the seeds, of the soy seeds in the world. The resistance was very strong, even in some of the countries. For example, France was dominating in Europe in terms of resisting bioengineered products. Brazil said they will never make products that are bioengineered, and they decided not to do soy until they found out that they were not competitive in the world.
Right.
And they changed their minds.
Did you anticipate that kind of resistance?
Yes, we did. That's why we stayed with products that cannot be identified on the dining room table.
Yeah, although the company wasn't able to avoid that kind of controversy, and agriculture biotechnology has run up against quite a few obstacles from public resistance. And you anticipated that?
Yes, we did. That's why I said we were trying to avoid a major catastrophe by the products we made.
Right.
But we thought that eventually, with the world, demands for products coming for wheat and corn and other things, mm-hmm. We felt that eventually this thing would die away. And it has practically died away. It is no longer... I know Monsanto Agriculturals. I still keep in touch with them. Mm-hmm. I know that is not a major concern of them anymore.
Yeah, you don't think it's an obstacle, the regulatory...
No, it is not. As a matter of fact, it's evident for that. Monsanto is trying to change that opinion of not having anything on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Genetically engineered melons now.
Yes.
And
did you ever consider doing any kind of education and sort of
No, we did not.
Yeah.
I thought that we thought that education would bring the project in front of everybody.
Uh-huh.
We'd rather try to have it disappear gradually by itself.
Uh-huh. I see. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we come to 1980. Any more questions until...
No, go ahead, please.
Yeah, we come to 1980 when we decide to restructure the company.
Right.
And in the article that you have there, you will find out the conditions under which we decided to restructure the company.
Mm-hmm.
Restructure it in what we call a parallel way. In other words, continue our existing businesses and in parallel create the biotechnology-based products.
Mm-hmm.
We decided to do it in parallel because we did not want to disrupt the whatever products we kept. We wanted that to run without interference from the growing biotechnology businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't even want it overlapping of managers or management teams.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did is we selected 30 to 40 year olds, our top performing younger executives. We took them away from the main thrust of the company. And we brought them to the biotechnology related activities. After we trained them to understand the biotechnology and to understand, it was an extensive training period of these 24 young executives.
Mm-hmm.
And so in essence, we had two separate companies running at that time. Then in 1984, I believe. About 1984, we decided to do... No, it was 1986. We decided to literally split the companies.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep the agricultural division as Monsanto, leave it the name, Monsanto, then to put our pharmaceutical activities in Cyril, which we acquired by then,
mm-hmm.
and then to have the remaining chemical products of ours, petrochemical-based products, to externalize them in a company called Solutia.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, three companies were formed. We soon realized, by the way, let me talk a little bit about Cyril.
Okay.
We acquired Cyril and negotiated with Don Rumsfeld, who was then the CEO of Cyril.
Mm-hmm.
We went to him and we asked that we buy the pharmaceutical business of Cyril. Besides the pharmaceutical business, they had the NutraSweet business, the aspartame business, which was a very profitable business.
Mm-hmm.
This is the NutraSweet that you get as on the table.
Right. And you had been following that from Genex. Genex was involved with that early on and got into some trouble there, right?
Yeah, that's correct. But that had all gone when we went to Cyril.
Mm-hmm.
And originally, Don Rumsfeld said, unless you buy the whole company, we can't split it up and give you the pharmaceuticals. We went back home, and I remember we went back home, and about 12 o'clock that night, my financial guy called me up and said, you know something, let me come over and show you something. I said, 1 o'clock at night? He said, yeah, I'd like to come over. So he came over and he had one graph and a transparency to put over the graph.
Mm-hmm.
And the graph showed Monsanto's cash flow,
mm-hmm.
Which had a major dip because of the fact that we sold a lot of businesses and are spending a lot in biotechnology.
Right.
So, and then he put over the transparency, which were the cash flow from NutraSweet, and it filled the gap.
Hmm.
So we went the next morning and acquired Cyril.
Mm-hmm. How much more did you have to pay for that piece of the company?
We bought it for $3.2 billion.
Mm-hmm. What had been the figure that you were talking about for just the pharmaceutical arm?
Oh, that was we thought, because we didn't know the whole story, we thought that the pharmaceutical yield would be about 60%.
Uh-huh.
It was the other way around.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we acquired Cyril, and we then had the three units, the three parts of Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
The Cyril, who put our pharmaceutical, and of course at that time Celebrex developing, Solutia to be the remnants of our past, of past Monsanto,
mm-hmm.
and of course the agricultural to be Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, then we soon realized that Cyril was too small. It didn't have the critical mass required for a company to grow and survive in the industry.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Even with the new technology, you didn't think that the new technology could leverage. They didn't have genetic engineering, right? But you had it elsewhere in the company.
That is correct. But we still thought that we needed a critical mass for a pharmaceutical industry to mm-hmm. compete in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
So we went and negotiated with Pharmacia, and Pharmacia and Cyril united. This was, of course, after my time. Pharmacia and Cyril united, and then, by the way, when we started to market Celebrex, we immediately realized that we did not have the field group
marketing
large enough to market Celebrex.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we went to Pfizer and we asked them if they would co-market it for us.
Mm-hmm.
And they agreed to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that was why after Pharmacia and Serum united, Pfizer acquired them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so that...
Did you have an idea of how big Celebrex was going to be?
No. We thought it was going to be much less than what it became.
Would that have made a difference in terms of the strategy for reorganizing?
That's an interesting question. Yes, it would have been. Mm-hmm. Perhaps Cyril could have had the critical mass through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Perhaps Cyril could have acquired some companies to increase it, especially emerging biotechnology companies,
mm-hmm.
to increase its size.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, we didn't dream that Celebrex would be what it is.
Yeah.
Especially after Viax disappeared.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It was a mistake by Merck.
Mm-hmm.
It was a major mistake.
Yeah. Well, before we move on from this period, I would like to ask, during the 80s, starting in the early 80s, as you're building up the agricultural piece with new biotechnologies, you mentioned that you were bringing in, that you put the best and brightest, the young executives into this area. You're at a very high level here. Who are some of the, can you name some of the names, some of the people that you brought in, and some of the executives, some of the research managers, some of the scientists that were important to developing this part of Monsanto?
Yes, let me think for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the number one guy.
Mm-hmm.
Is the man that became the CEO of Monsanto, Mahoney.
Uh-huh.
Dick Mahoney.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Mahoney, at that time, when we were selecting young executives. Is that my call or yours?
I think it's yours. Do you want to take it?
Hold on a minute.
Sure.
No, it's all finished.
Okay.
When we were selecting the young, promising executives, Mahoney was selling Domats.
Hmm.
You remember AstroTurf was created by Monsanto.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And there were Domats made out of AstroTurf.
Uh-huh.
Probably remember.
I do remember those, yes.
And Mahoney was in charge of those, mm-hmm. out of Springfield, Massachusetts.
Hmm.
And he was in the New Enterprise Division, because that's where AstroTurf started.
Uh-huh.
And
where did you find the technology for that, or the process for making
the AstroTurf?
Yeah.
Oh, it was very interesting. We were, of course, deeply in textiles.
Right.
And Monsanto was in the process, the New Enterprise Division was in the process of making unwoven textiles.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the Astrodome was built, they were planning to plant grass.
Mm-hmm.
And they soon found out that grass could not grow because there wasn't enough sunshine coming.
Right. Yeah.
So they were in a predicament. So they went to DuPont and they went to us and they went to all the textile companies and they said, help us. is there any way we can make something to pave the grounds?
Mm-hmm.
And they had come to me, for example. I was then in the New Enterprise Division, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that wasn't quite what I had in mind for the tech, for the division to do, and the textile division was not interested. So I brought it up at a technical meeting we had, and one guy popped up and said, Costa, you know, on the side I was creating a flat fiber for making baskets, weaving it and making baskets. I said, it's yellow, he said, but we can paint it green. And I think we can put it together with our machines and make something that looks like grass.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it came. The AstroTurf.
Mm-hmm.
And we called it AstroTurf because of Astrodome.
Right.
Yeah.
But you probably didn't anticipate a large market for that.
No, we didn't. But nevertheless, it was a favor, really, more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, there was a high school in St. Louis who said, I'd love to have that instead of me maintaining grass and all that. So we put a strip of that, and we put one of that for their football field, a small, actually, portion. And mm-hmm. Other universities saw it, etc., and AstroTurf first went to universities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the professionals came in
mm-hmm.
and took it over, etc. Yeah. We sold it eventually. We sold it. It wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
And we sold it to the people who were marketing it.
Uh-huh. I see. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Yes, it mm-hmm. was.
So Dick Mahoney was he was in Massachusetts and
we brought him to St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And he was among the young men that was there.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, there was an interesting situation when we decided to make we decided to have these new bunch of executives
right.
trained. Our CEO and chairman said to us, you realize that some of you older folks are going to be useless if we move totally into the biotechnology-based product, because these young men will be there, and you haven't trained like this to be there.
Right.
So he said, look, some of you might have to retire early, and I will compensate you as if you retired at 65, which we were all officers of the company were obliged to retire at
mm-hmm.
65. I will compensate you. If you're only 60, I would give you 5 years' salary, and your pension would be accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was right. He said, except one person, and that person is Costas.
Ah.
Because of his involvement in the technology that is emerging, and because of his technical mm-hmm. knowledge of the company, he will stay until he's 65, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
But many of my contemporaries left. Some went to other companies, some retired
mm-hmm.
Earlier and were compensated accordingly. So there was no major problem associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
But the new bunch of managers took over.
Right.
And eventually they dominated, of course, the Monsanto part, the agricultural part,
mm-hmm.
and some of them went with Cyril to Pharmacia and then acquired by Pfizer.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting and I think quite unique how a company was totally transformed by an emerging technology.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back, there was no way in 1975 that I or anybody else could have forecasted that emerging technology would change a company so radically,
mm-hmm.
in Monsanto. And of course, our early awareness of biotechnology made us what we are, made Monsanto what it is today. And I think DuPont and the others had to catch up,
right,
with our agricultural operation.
Yeah, and I think the same is true that in other industries, in pharmaceuticals, I don't think any of the big corporations adopted. I mean, they were keeping an eye on the new technology, but they didn't integrate. In pharmaceuticals, it was, you know, the startup, entrepreneurial startups that really commercialized the technology. So Monsanto might be unique, I think, maybe in all industries in which biotechnology had an impact. What's your feeling about that?
Yes, there is no question in my mind about that. And that's why the pharmaceutical companies in the beginning looked at biotechnology as, you know, as another technology that they'll get to it at some time.
Right.
And later on they had to hustle to acquire this company and that emerging enterprise and that emerging in order to get themselves into this new technology. No mm-hmm. question about it. That's another example of an industry that is not aware of technology or markets that's going to totally impact them. And that's why, you know, all innovative things or most innovative things happen through a different company
mm-hmm.
than they did, they should have.
Mm-hmm.
But Monsanto was one that really changed its stripes. As I state in this presentation, which you have a copy of and which I gave to the Business Week executive.
This is Biotechnology, the Promise and the Price. Is that the one you're referring to?
Yeah, the corporate.
Yes. Right.
Yeah, Managing Change. Yeah. And as I said at the end of that, some people said, you're changing, you're totally changing, can you handle that? And my reaction was that you can tell that what we are really doing is redirecting our talents to where the action is.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, we had no trouble understanding biotechnology. It was chemistry, organic chemistry, and we were an organic chemistry. We had many specialty products. We understood organic chemistry. We were not just textiles and inorganic type of products. We had organic products. We understood that technology.
But there's also the biological aspect where you're manipulating genes and growing things in bacteria and those sorts of things. I mean, those were unfamiliar territories, weren't they?
Yes, they were. As I said, we were not strangers to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let me go back a little bit, if I may, with our venture capital activity.
Yes, please.
We started, of course, Innovent.
Right. And let me ask about Innovent. Emerson Electric is also involved in that. What was
that
relationship?
That's right. When we wanted to start it, my board said to me, you can only have $1 million a year, $1.5 million a year. And I said, $1.5 million isn't enough. Mm-hmm. I need 3 or 4. and they would not give it to me, so I went to Emerson, which I knew well, people there, and said, would you like to come in? Because what Inhofen would be looking at for your opportunity and ours are not, do not overlap.
Uh-huh.
So they can look for your opportunities as well as ours. So we went 50-50, and I got the $3.5 million I needed a year.
Mm-hmm.
But Emerson wasn't very interested in. So in essence, it was really Monsanto-oriented primarily.
So they put money in, but you were managing the investments. Is that what you mean?
Correct.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was CEO and chairman of Monsanto's. We have a separate division called the Monsanto Venture Capital Division.
Mm-hmm.
And I was that until I left Monsanto.
I see. Uh-huh. In addition to other posts that you were holding.
I always said that as a secondary situation.
And how did you divide your time? Did it?
I allocated most of this to Greg Johnson, who later I took off from Monsanto, started my own venture capital group when I retired.
Mm-hmm.
He was very good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Was actually the man that interacted with Genentech and GeneX, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't put that much time into it.
Yeah. Is he around?
A chairman than a CEO, although I had the title of both.
Right. So it was Greg Johnson, is that the name?
Yes.
Yeah, and is he around?
He's around. I'll talk to you about this in a minute.
Okay.
Let
me ask about Advent and Gateway Venture Partners.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to give the history.
Okay, sure.
If I may.
Yes, please.
So the first fund was Inhofen, and that was our only fund that we were associated with. Until I went to Europe in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I went to Europe, I found out that venture capital in Europe, they couldn't even spell venture capital, never mind ever one.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to start one in Europe, and I chose the British, I chose Great Britain, simply because there they had a secondary market.
Mm-hmm.
Our companies can be involved with, like we have in this country. So I started Advent UK.
Right.
As always, I wanted to have a professional manager manage it, as opposed to Monsanto doing it. And it was then that I met Brooke.
Mm-hmm.
And he arranged for me to get a manager for Advent International, for Advent UK. It was our first real venture capital fund in England. There were others, but they were not really venture capital in the classical sense. So we started, and my problem was, I'm starting a venture capital group, but where is this fund going to be getting its ideas? So I thought that I need to talk to Oxford and Cambridge universities,
mm-hmm.
which I did, and they agreed not only to help us externalize to use us to externalize some of their technology, but also they decided to be investors in it. So we raised about $16 million, of which Monsanto put 10, and each of the universities put $3 million in. And David Cooksey was the fellow that Brooks brought in, and he eventually became Sir David Cooksey because of his activities in Advent, UK. Mm-hmm. But that gave me, obviously, the opportunity to work with the venture capital related environment in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some, the Oxford Oligosystems, for example, which was a very prominent company, was externalized and created by the fund.
Mm-hmm.
Let me have some water. Can you excuse me a minute?
Certainly.
Okay, so that was my relationship with Peter Brook.
Yeah, could you tell me just briefly of Peter Brook's background?
Yes, Peter Brook is the founder of Advent International,
mm-hmm.
which is now, as you know, a large private investment company.
Right.
Originally, let me tell you how it started, and then I'll talk about Peter.
Okay.
When I asked Peter Brook to help me identify a manager for Advent UK, he was in charge of a precursor of what is now Advent International. I forgot the name of that company, but it was a venture capital group, so he was among the first. He started his venture capital group around 1965 or 66,
mm-hmm.
which was still the early stage for venture capital.
Right.
And so he was willing to help me, as I said, find David Cooksey, who ran. And I had written a paper about corporate venture capital, which was the name I gave venture capital groups that cater exclusively to a particular corporation, as opposed to venture capital groups who are for-profit groups,
mm-hmm.
have multiple investors in them.
Right.
So I call that corporate venture capital. And by the time I met with Peter Brook in 1980, 81, Innovent had shown some success, obviously. And we have developed a model. And I said to him, why can't you develop a company that will copy this model? You can go to individual companies, tell them to give you 20 or 25 million, and create a fund explicitly aimed at that particular company.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that's a good idea, and he formed Advent International, and I was co-founder of that. I sat on the board of that company. And in about 4 years, we had 9 companies, including Microsoft, each of which had its own venture capital group.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, of course, Peter Brook, still active in Advent International, looked at bigger and better things, according to him, bigger primarily, and went from classical venture capital, which he still operates, he went to private investors. prior to investment operations. So that's the story of Peter Brook. He was one of the original venture capitalists, and he still he became quite prominent in terms of Advent International. Then in 1984, I wanted to establish in the United... Oh, by the way, with Peter Brook, when he decided to have a parallel fund of his own, that is, you know, the classical type, as opposed to corporate venture capital, when he decided to do that almost from the beginning, I said, if you will start venture capital groups in the world, anywhere in the world, Monsanto will give you, will make a major investment in it. So we started, he started a fund in Japan, and we invested in it. He started a fund in France, and we invested in it, etc. So Monsanto had extensive, a kind of covered the whole world, more or less, in terms of the venture capitalizing he has required.
Right, and you had full confidence in Peter Brook.
Yes, I did.
And from Monsanto's point of view, is what's the balance in terms of objective between return on investment and access to new technologies?
We didn't have to make that. That's the beauty of it. When Innovent started investing in Genentech and Biogen, etc., and our couple of millions ended up to be 20 or 30.
Yeah.
I had no problem with the board.
Right, yeah.
The board cannot look primarily at the profits, of the immediate profits which venture capital yield to us, and realize that there were long-term and short-term benefits from corporate venture capital. I really didn't have that problem. But originally, our intent was to use it as eyes and ears.
Right.
Not expect much in return. Then when I came back to from Europe, I thought now that we were deeply in venture capital, I mean in biotechnology,
right,
I needed a venture capital fund that is exclusively devoted to venture capital. So I looked around for an individual with reputation in that field, and obviously who popped up but Moshe Alafi. Now, it happened that Moshe Alafi was sitting on the same board with our vice chairman in Biogen. So, Moshe Alafi was not stranger to us. So I asked him, would he help me start a Monsanto corporate venture capital dedicated to venture capital alone? And that is how Moshe Alafi Capital was formed. And what the first company we created from Monsanto's technology was Invitron, I-N-V-I-T-R-O-N. And it was created for this reason. Monsanto, in the new enterprise division and in the jointly with the textile division, had created what we called hollow fine fibers, which we used originally for separation.
Right.
Or fluids, fluid separation. Some would penetrate the surfaces of this hollow fiber, and some would not. And then someone from our venture capital group, from our biotechnology group, said, you know, these fibers look to me like veins and arteries. Can we grow cells and let those micro fibers, hollow fibers, act as veins and arteries, arteries to bring food to the cells and veins to take away whatever is undesirable there.
Mm-hmm.
And we created this artificial, if you wish, body that cells will grow beautifully around us.
Mm-hmm. Were the first applications in monoclonal antibody production?
It was in the cell growth. We were not at that time thinking of monoclonal antibodies.
Uh-huh. But it was adapted at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't, because the idea of it used in biological systems was sitting on the side there, unattended to, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was until Judah Faulkner from Harvard found out about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they called, and he called us, and he said, you know, my work in angiogenesis factor, I have to grow the cells in eggs. Your system would be ideal for me. Would you please allow me to use it? And that is how we came to know Judah Faulkner. And of course, at that time, Harvard had the funds from us to help Judah Faulkner's work.
Yeah, that was from 1974, right? The first contact with Faulkner?
Correct.
Yeah.
And so, Judah Faulkner's work, which of course is now the prominent future, as a major future.
Right.
Was started by Monsanto's money and technology.
Mm-hmm.
And then when those funds were all used up, Judah came to me. That was about in the early 80s, I think, middle 80s, perhaps, and said, Costa, can I have some more money? And I said, Judah, unfortunately, your technology will take about 30 years to develop, and that's too long for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did not fund him anymore, although some of his patents had Monsanto relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I proved right. It took 30 years or so for it to develop.
And those, a number of products have been developed with his technology. Did Monsanto still have a hand in any of that?
No. Mm-hmm. They do not. Well, Monsanto is not in the pharmaceutical.
Right, right, yeah.
I don't know if Pfizer has a relationship, but mm-hmm. of course Judah died.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so then Moshe Alafi came over, and we formed Invitron, the first company that will contract this growth of cells.
Mm-hmm.
So we had big vats that a company would come in and say, I want to grow these cancer cells to produce product X, etc. It was quite successful, until we realized that growing the cells for the production of biologicals will become an integral part of every company,
mm-hmm.
will not be contracted out.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided that there is no future in Invitron as an independent company. Mm-hmm. And we put it out for sale. And it was acquired by Chiron.
Right. What were the dates there, do you recall? The founding and then the sale?
Oh, the founding. The founding was 1985, I believe.
Uh-huh. You had started with Moshe Alafi in 1984?
Yeah, that was Moshe Alafi's venture group first activity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Starting a company from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was around 1985.
Yeah, and then it was sold to Chiron. Do you recall the year?
After I left, probably 1990.
Yeah, okay.
Like that.
Right.
Moshe Alafi, Moshe Alafi and I also created a venture group that was dedicated specifically to technology from Washington University in St. Louis.
So this is Gateway Venture Partners?
No.
No.
Not yet.
Okay.
No, it was called AW Venture Company.
Uh-huh.
A venture capital fund. A.W. Alafi, Washington University.
I see. Uh-huh. Okay.
That was about the time I was leaving Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
And Moshe stayed with us, with the company, for about 5 years, 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
About 4 or 5 years. And then it was dissolved. Around 1985. By that time, Mahoney was CEO of the company.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but CEO. And I was sitting one day and we said, gee, we've got venture capital groups all over the world and we don't have one in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, okay. We said, okay, let's form one. So we formed
Gateway.
Gateway Associates. We brought in the head of one of the banks in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And with the understanding that when I retired in 2 years, I will join him.
Mm-hmm.
The charter of the fund was to develop at least 50% of its funds in Missouri corporations.
Was that somebody's requirement, the bank's requirement, or?
No, nobody's, because all the money came from us.
Uh-huh.
Monsanto.
Uh-huh.
It was our requirement.
Uh-huh.
But if this is going to be a fund located in St. Louis and the purpose of locating it is to help the state, it should have at least a percentage of it in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And so we formed Gateway Associates, one, and when I retired, I joined them.
Mm-hmm.
Then we formed Gateway Associates 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then when 4th was ready to be formed, I said, at my age, I do not want to participate other than to advise you. And so the two other partners, because the guy that started it, Dick Ford, and I were the senior members, and we both decided not to be involved in fund number 4.
Mm-hmm.
And the two other younger people, the one was Greg Johnson white blood from Monsanto.
Right.
And he was the one, he and I were the one that handled the biotechnology-related investments.
Right.
And then another one, together with Ford, was developing communications primarily related funds. And so they split into two, and Prologue is the name of the fourth fund from the biotech point of view.
Uh-huh, and that's Greg Johnson still.
That's Greg Johnson still working at
it. Yeah. And throughout the entire period, throughout all four funds, was the localized focus maintained 50% in Missouri?
No, it was not maintained after the first, because then Monsanto did not put any money in.
I see. Yeah.
The first one. Well, Monsanto put some money on the second, but not enough to dominate it.
Yeah. And so, I'm not familiar with St. Louis, but it has a vital high-tech industry or community ever taken root there?
Well, more than that. Mm-hmm. The Wall Street Journal, about 3 months ago, mentioned St. Louis as the new emerging biotech center.
Uh-huh.
And that, let me tell you a little bit about that.
Sure.
In 1980, when I came back from Europe, I thought, Dick Mahoney and I, thought that we should create an incubator in St. Louis because of Washington University prominence.
Right.
I don't know if you know, but Washington University got 60% of the funds that government devoted to the genome.
Right, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so we thought that that and Monsanto being there, it would be a good idea to form an incubator. So we formed an incubator. I was chairman of it. It was 1983. And today that incubator expanded significantly, has about 24 of biotech-related companies. We also had the idea, which I thought was unique, and that we say, okay, we use an incubator to incubate companies after, and they need, you know, 1,000 square feet, 2,000 to 3,000 square feet. What happens when they need 10,000 square feet to go away somewhere if they can't find a space here? So I went to this to the city of St. Louis, and I said, "You've got a lot of land that is sitting there with all these dilapidated homes, etc. Why can't you give the incubator the grounds there and let us build facilities that will accommodate the next stage of emerging companies?" And that is now in place, and companies then graduate from our biotech center into these facilities where they can get 5,000 and 10,000 square feet.
So you have a couple of dozen new companies. Are they mostly focused in genomics and agriculture, or is it broader than that?
It's broader than that in the sense that any emerging company, whether it's in electronics or whatever else, our incubator is only for products in a broad sense related to life sciences. But the new facilities are for any company that wishes to come in there that is in its early stages of development. That was the requirement by the city. They didn't want to be specific to one industry.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the story. Now, when I left Gateway, when Gateway ended, I became a kind of a angel investor.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to still continue sitting on boards and helping companies, etc. And so I sat primarily on the boards of some of the emerging life science companies in the incubator.
Mm-hmm.
And not representing Advent 4, which was really called Prologue now.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the company, for example, Curios, that I was on the board, chairman and founder from 03 to 07.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm now only sitting on one board, which is DeltaGen.
Mm-hmm.
DeltaGen is the premier transgenic mouse company.
Uh-huh.
And it's located in San Francisco, San Mateo.
Mm-hmm.
And I was called in 01 to help it get out of Chapter 11, which it got out, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
And we are expanding DeltaGen now. We were prominent in, of course, the transgenic mice, but by being in the transgenic mice business, we have a high reputation for service by the industry,
mm-hmm.
the pharmaceutical industry, and so we thought that we can expand in that particular service area.
Mm-hmm.
And we built a service laboratory in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Producing antibodies for companies, customized antibodies?
Yes, that plus also helping them with all the processes that involve phase one clinical.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Right. A CRL.
Mm-hmm.
A CRL operation.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And Curios, tell me a little bit about that company. You were involved with them for a number of years.
Yes. Curios had this idea and came over from from Washington University.
Mm-hmm.
We had the idea, or rather the professor at Washington University, a group of professors, had the idea that if they had the thought that perhaps there are other ways of using pharmaceuticals or using products to attack cancer, using chemotherapeutic products, instead of giving it to the body and having it go all over, can we direct it to the cancer site?
Mm-hmm.
And can we do that in the early stages of cancer?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was, can we develop what I called a FedEx approach to it? Have a carrier carrying the product that we want to deliver to the cancer,
mm-hmm.
having a directional identity, something that will direct it there, and having something that we know that is there. In other words, a kind of a response.
Mm-hmm.
And so we created a product that involved. Excuse me, I'm getting.
Certainly.
That had both the chemotherapeutic agent that had a monoclonal antibody to go there, and that it had a heavy metal so that the MRI can detect it. And that's the technology that Kyrios is pursuing.
I see. So you're putting a number of different things on the antibody simultaneously.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And obviously we have a carrier for all these. And it has proven very difficult. And so Kyrios has been working at it for quite a while.
Yeah. Well, it's a good idea, but a very tough thing to accomplish. Yeah.
Very tough. So that was Kyrios until 07 when I left St. Louis, and therefore I didn't feel I could be chairman.
Yeah. And you're in Detroit now.
Yes, I moved in Detroit in 07. The reason for that is my wife has an extended family here.
I see.
And I felt that at my age, I am 90 years old, that at my age, she would need moral support when she takes care of me. So I moved here. We built a nice home here in our golf club grounds.
Very good.
And so that's, in essence, the story.
Yeah, I have one question, just to go back just briefly to 1982 with Advent. Advent invests in Genzyme. Genzyme was not doing recombinant DNA. They were working with enzymes.
That is correct, yes.
Yeah.
And they were working with enzymes and for Gaucher's disease primarily.
Right.
They came to Advent International, and Advent invested in them.
Were you involved in that decision?
To invest in Genzyme, yes, I was. But in a very peripheral way, I was on the board. And in an indirect way, Peter Brook decided to invest in it, and his people went and brought it up to the board. The board never argued about investing in or not. So it was really not a decision by the board.
Right.
And then when a couple of years later, Peter asked me if I would sit on the board, and I said, and I learned about Genzyme, and I found out that they were in the process of considering going public. And I did not want to sit on a company that was about to go public. So I said no, and one of his men sat there with the understanding that after it finished going public, I would sit on the board.
Why did you not want to go on the on the board while the company was in the process of going public?
I always resisted being at a time where the company went public. The reason was more in terms of time involvement in the company.
I see.
More than anything else. It wasn't a matter of concern about anything else, but I think that to sit on a company when it goes public, it's a very time-consuming project.
Right.
And the board needs to be totally involved in it.
Yeah.
Not arm's length. So at that particular time, I was still at Monsanto.
Right.
I had gotten permission to sit on the board of Advent International, as I had to get for sitting on any boards, and I thought that I would not have the time to justify, to give to the company go public.
Right.
So now, soon after it went public, I sat on the board.
Yeah, and by that, by the time you accepted that invitation, Henry Chimera was already in place as president of the company.
Well, let me say also, it's very interesting. The founder of Advent International was, of course, I forgot the name.
Mm-hmm. I can look it up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see it, but I will find it. Are you there, Costa? Yeah, you were saying?
Yes, just one second.
Okay. Have we covered everything?
Yes, I think we've covered everything. You will get some more details about Monsanto's transformation from the managing change document.
Right.
A write-up I have there.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And
okay, very good.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate your input. What we will do is we'll produce a transcript and send it back to you for your review. And it's a wonderful story. My pleasure. Thank you very much, Costa.
It was a pleasure talking to you. And please, if you have any questions in the future, Mark, don't hesitate to call me. I would be happy to talk.